Well, 2 weeks to go before Thanksgiving, and the weather is changing quite predictably. We have high wind warnings here, forecast for mid-Michigan, and out west, the snow has begun. Up to a foot of snow fell in parts of Colorado and Wyoming, which is not that extraordinary this time of year in that part of the country, obviously, but earlier in the week, up to 10 inches of snow in the Reno area, according to the Weather Channel, so they can keep the snow out there a little bit longer, but we have winds to contend with here today, so we hope everything is battened down that needs to be battened down. It's current state here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the top of our program today, state leaders have set what seems to be a lofty goal for Michigan's K through 12 science students. By 2022, 7 years from now, officials want 85% of them to be proficient in the subject. We have quite a way to go. 2 years ago, more than 80% of Michigan's elementary and middle school students failed the science portion of the old MEEP test. Many Michigan educators are confident that the new standards, formally approved on Tuesday, will lead to greater science proficiency. The new standards are aimed at getting young learners to think more like scientists. Late yesterday, I spoke with a supporter of the new standards. Rob Stevenson is a former Michigan Teacher of the Year. Today, he's a STEM consultant. That's science, technology, engineering, and math for the Ingham Intermediate School District. I first asked about three key components at the heart of the new standards. The first, that every student do science. I asked what that means.
That is actually referencing the science and engineering practices that are a part of the standards. And in the most simple terms, this is really replicating how field science actually works. And so they're going to be asking questions, defining problems, engaging in argument from evidence. There's a series of eight of those practices that are encompassed in that leg of the stool.
So being scientists?
Correct.
Is it more about doing what scientists actually do?
That is exactly what this is. And the easiest way to understand the Michigan science standards is to think about what field science really is and now do it in the classroom. Mm.
They also need to stay engaged with core ideas. What are a few of these core ideas?
This would be what teachers would typically see in the past as your basic content. And so it might be when we start talking about pushes and pulls in kindergarten, for example. These are going to be the basic disciplinary core ideas or content that the teachers have always taught in the past. It's just going to be much more rich as far as the experience.
And finally, they need to connect these core ideas with bigger concepts. What does that mean?
Correct. That one's referencing the cross-cutting concepts. So an example of that would be like cause and effect. So we can see cause and effect in lots of different content areas or domains, not just within science. We can see that in mathematics. We can see it in language arts. We can see it in social studies. We can see that in many different areas.
Now, a colleague of yours, Robbie Kramer, who is executive director of the Michigan Science Teachers Association, told the Detroit Free Press recently that the standards reflect research that provides greater clarity about how kids learn. What do we know now about how kids learn that we didn't know in the past?
Well, what's really interesting is if you think about traditional science, now this is very stereotypical, and I'm certainly not talking about every classroom, but if you can imagine a lecture experience where students are passively receiving that information, we sort of think about that as recitation almost. And a teacher may ask a question, the students respond, the teacher answers either yes or no with an evaluative response. What's happening here is far more rich, in fact. What we're going to be seeing with the students as far as these experiences, the kids are going to be looking at phenomenon. They're observing phenomenon. They're going to try to grapple with making meaning of that phenomenon without information just being handed to them. So the students are really doing the heavy lifting as they're trying to understand these phenomenon and asking questions and developing explanations for what it is that they're seeing. And then they'll get into the whole research and application, obtaining information and putting it together with their own understanding of this phenomenon. It's actually quite exciting.
We're talking with Rob Stevenson, former Michigan Teacher of the Year from Okemos, about the state's newly approved science teaching standards, approved Tuesday by the State Board of Education. Rob's a STEM advisor, that's science, technology, engineering, and math for the Ingham Intermediate School District, and he is a supporter of the new standards. He's also a host of WKAR-TV's Curious Crew. We'll get that in there. Now, the goals recommend a greater emphasis on real-world examples in instruction. Why is that more important than it was in the past?
Well, what we found is if you think about a traditional classroom, as I was alluding to before, you can imagine the students being rather passive in that experience. And it was really built on understanding concepts and memorizing. If you think about memorizing terms, those vocabulary words that might have been drafted up on the board that you had to memorize, this is far different. What we've discovered is if we want students to really understand science, they have to do science. Now, we have a wonderful array of teachers around the state and around the country that integrate hands-on experiences and investigations with the students, and that's the first step. But what these standards are asking is now we're going to go deeper in making sure that the students really understand the connections for the content itself, and so they can understand and explain that phenomenon and even identify it in other examples in the natural world.
I'm thinking back on the recommendation that students actually do science. Mm-hmm. Labs have been a part of science classrooms for many years already.
Correct.
Does this mean more lab work?
It means more hands-on investigations, to be sure. The difference is what comes after they've grappled with this initial phenomenon. Typically, what has happened in the past is we go through a very rigid procedural format. So the kids follow this list of steps in an experiment, for example, and then come to some resolution or conclusion that is almost provided by the teacher. This is going to be quite a bit different. We start with a phenomenon, and then the students collectively start working together to build and construct understanding of what they've just observed. And that's when we start taking this to a much deeper level. Memorization isn't going to be the start. We're not starting with vocabulary terms. The vocabulary starts coming in within context as the students are starting to understand what it is that they've just witnessed.
And this represents a shift?
It does, dramatically, actually. And I think about my own instruction when I was in the classroom, and I was a big supporter of starting every lesson with a discrepant event, some sort of phenomenon that really engaged the students and made them wonder and question and dig in. And what I find fascinating is even though I was giving opportunity for the kids to wrestle with these issues and trying to come up with an explanation, I didn't extend it deep enough so that the students could really start understanding the relationships of what it was they just observed and really becoming reliant on the evidence to be able to justify their thinking. The other thing that's really fascinating is the use of models. You'll see this in the standards throughout, developing models. And these can be physical models. They could be models that the kids are formulating within their own thinking. It could be a diagram model to capture and demonstrate their understanding of a phenomenon as they're building their knowledge.
The new standards, I take it, the new standards also mandate some amount of engineering.
Correct.
Do I have that right?
You do.
Why is that?
Well, if we think about science and engineering, we have obviously a lot of engineering within our country as far as opportunities for work. But when we think about the similarities between engineering and science, we can either define problems within engineering. We can ask questions within science. We can construct explanations in science. We can design solutions in engineering. One of the benefits that I see with engineering really is it helps students become effective problem solvers. Whether they're going to pursue a job in a STEM field or not, it really leads students into thinking about how you can define a problem and then develop a solution to resolve it.
Mm. We face some pretty significant science teaching challenges in this state, do
yes,
we not?
Yes, we do.
Teaching and learning.
Correct.
Are you confident that these standards are going to make a lot of impact on that? We've set some pretty high goals.
We have.
And we're quite a way short of those goals right
Correct.
Now.
Correct. I like this question. Because it sort of leads me to a couple of things to be celebrating, but also to be cautious about. Whenever we come up with new standards, most people want to be thinking in terms of a checklist. I've done this standard. I've done that standard, mm-hmm. and check them off. Mm-hmm. That's not the way these work. the standards themselves are actually performance expectations. And so it really is a matter of shifting the way we are teaching the science and giving different experiences for students so that they can construct an explanation, so that they can develop a model on an assessment, which is vastly different from a fill-in-the-blank or a multiple choice or something memorized on an assessment previously. So that's quite a bit different. I find that exciting, but here's the thing that we have to be cautious about. Because this is such a dramatic shift, I worry that school districts around the state will jump onto the next great curriculum. And because this is still relatively new, I have yet to see a great curriculum that is instilling this kind of instruction. And so we have to be patient and optimistic at the same time.
Rob Stevenson is former Michigan Teacher of the Year. We're talking about the state's newly approved science teaching standards, which were approved this week by the State Board of Education. Both the Common Core standards and the standards on which these new science benchmarks are based, which are called the Next Generation Science Standards, continue to generate some amount of opposition and resistance. Have you heard any valid points raised by skeptics?
Well, the thing that I always find intriguing is change is hard, obviously, and people are going to be resistant to any sort of change, whether it's going to impact their children or whether it's a teacher impacting their students. And so I think that is the first concern that we have to be sympathetic to. We have to understand where the angst often comes from. But I like to turn the question around, and I like to pose something different to you, to the listeners. And when I think about what the intent of the Common Core is and the next generation science standards, the intent is to try to think more deeply about content and make connections to the natural world, to our environment, to one another, to understanding mathematics and language arts and science in a way that we haven't asked of kids before. And I think that's something to celebrate. What often happens, though, is depending upon how the information was originally delivered, there may be some pushback because the understanding of what the intent might be too narrow, and it may be too attached to a certain curriculum or a certain problem, and that can be counterproductive as well.
Are Michigan science teachers up to adopting these standards and really making them work? I mean, is there enough buy-in, or does resistance concern you?
Well, I've been working through the state with some national science leaders for quite some time now, and we've actually been going through a very interesting learning process as we've really dug into the standards and approach them as a learner as well as a facilitator or a teacher. And one of the things that I find exciting is going through an experience like that where you reshape your own thinking as a learner, learning in this method is exciting because suddenly you start looking at the natural world a little bit differently and you're noticing connections that you'd never even considered before. The teachers who are currently in the field, they need an experience like that. The requirement for professional development will be significant. And I urge districts to be cognizant of that because this isn't something that can be infused immediately. This is something that will take some time so teachers understand what these shifts are and how to effectively bring this into the classroom. I am very confident our science teachers in Michigan are up to the challenge, and I'm certainly confident that they have the content knowledge that can be supportive of executing it well. It's just a matter of providing ample time and professional development.
We're talking about Michigan's newly approved science teaching standards for K through 12. They were approved Tuesday by the State Board of Education. Rob Stevenson's a former Michigan Teacher of the Year, and today he is a STEM advisor, that's science, technology, engineering, and math for the Ingham Intermediate School District. He's a supporter of the new standards and host of WKAR-TV's Curious Crew, another new season coming
Yes, we're very excited about that, too.
Very good. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Many thanks for joining us. This Saturday's MSU football halftime show will feature the 300-strong Spartan Marching Band and a few guest artists. An additional 1,700 performers, instrumentalists, choirs, dancers, and more round out what promises to be one of the most spectacular multimedia events ever seen at Spartan Stadium, and it's seen its share. WKAR's Peter Wharf has more.
I had never been to a college football game before. It was overwhelming. It was beautiful.
New York-based artist Jennifer Wen Ma attended her first college football game earlier this fall when MSU faced the Oregon Ducks. But the Beijing native is no stranger to sports on the big stage. In 2008, Ma was one of the seven members on the core creative team for the opening and closing ceremonies of the Beijing Olympics, and the chief designer for visual and special effects. She won an Emmy for the U.S. broadcast of the ceremony. Jennifer Wen Ma is the artistic director behind this Saturday's MSU Maryland Spartan Marching Band halftime program entitled The Art of the March, Cues from Sun Tzu's The Art of War. To start the process of her unique halftime show vision, Ma arrived days before the MSU-Oregon game to gather inspiration at football and marching band practices.
I really had a full afternoon. I came here and went directly into a band practice, and that was just really amazing to see the energy of the kids.
On game day, Jennifer joined the Spartan faithful at the Spartan Marching Band warm-up next to the College of Music building on Adams Field.
And then we walked with them to go into that mile, to go into the stadium. And with the cheer of the crowd, with all the people there along, like all over campus doing the tailgate parties, that was a new experience for me.
In her mind, Jennifer Wen Ma began to create the marching band show, The Art of the March, initially inspired by the ancient Chinese military text, The Art of War by General Sun Tzu.
So The Art of War was kind of just a natural thing I fell on, and I started reading about that. And, you know, growing up in China, of course, I was aware of it.
As she explored the many layers of Sun Tzu, Ma began to envision a large-scale sound and sight experience featuring all Chinese music and many effects to suggest themes from Sun Tzu's ancient Chinese military text.
Talking about warfare, smoke. We'll be using a little bit of smoke, but in a very artistic way. And smoke is something we often associate with warfare, violence, and this type of atmosphere. But it's also very beautiful. There's also, I'm using it as like the fog. You know, like every time I've come to Michigan, I kind of see that fog rising out of the field. The program is kind of organized around like almost like a day in the life of a Spartan. From the morning fog rising, and you come into being. You work all day through the drills, through the practice. And then nighttime, you have brotherhood, sisterhood. You have comrades being together. But then when you're called to action, what do you do? How do you show your true colors? So we kind of constructed out of that.
This weekend's The Art of the March is one of the many activities that's grown out of an ongoing MSU-China cultural relationship.
It's a strong endorsement of MSU's 10th year now of the MSU-China initiative that was started by President Simon to foster greater and deeper engagement and sustained engagement with China.
That's MSU's Dr. Kurt Dewhurst, Director of Arts and Cultural Initiatives and Senior Fellow for University Outreach and Engagement. Dewhurst's arts and cultural leadership have led to a decade of programming at MSU museums, performance spaces, and elsewhere. Activities have recognized, among other projects, the university's U.S.-China exchange. Dewhurst and colleagues were looking for new ways to celebrate the relationship, ways to demonstrate the MSU-China global connection. Kurt Dewhurst takes us back to a China exchange meeting where the China football connection was made.
I don't remember saying it, but everyone on the committee said it was my idea. So I said, well, the biggest stage we have on campus is Spartan Stadium. And so we started to talk about that, and then I talked with Jim Forger, the Dean of the College of Music, and I said, well, what could we do there? And Jim said, well, let me start by talking to John Madden. Maybe we could do something with a halftime show. And then Min-Young Kim, who was at the time at the Broad Museum as the Director of External Relations, Min said, well, I've got an idea, somebody I know, and she happened to know from another past experience, Jennifer Wen Ma.
When Min-Jung Kim called me, and we've always wanted to collaborate together, and she said, I kind of have this crazy idea. What do you think about directing a football halftime show? And I said, that is a crazy idea. But I just thought, well, the way I kind of, I'm very open to different possibilities. I love new challenges, and I love new collaboration. I did a lot of research on the marching band. Their Spartan marching band is amazing.
As the project gathered momentum, it was passed next to MSU College of Music Dean James Forger, who began organizing his forces with Jennifer Wen Ma on something that started to resemble a halftime show.
The show itself has a dimension of focusing on one of our international partners, China, and celebrating their culture and history, the art of war, and it brings together individuals who typically might not be going to football, and Louis, one of our own trombonists from Shanghai, who happens to be in the Spartan marching band.
It's really a good chance, like, to perform with all those great members in the band, and I just can't imagine that this is true. But I don't know how to explain that.
Trombonist Louis Han is the Spartan marching band's first international student musician. His is one of the very personal stories of the MSU China experience, as he explained just after he joined the band two seasons ago.
I made it to the toughest band in the nation.
And, yep.
But I just love the Spartan marching band, and it was a really good honor to, it's lucky to get here. So, you know, it's a long way home right here, but I think I got a new family here with my trombone sections. You know, it's all about to see the world. People want to see the world. That's why we're here.
Louis Han and 300 of his closest friends will take the field Saturday, all led by Spartan Marching Band Director John T. Madden. With his team, Madden and Jennifer Wen Ma have been working on a complex series of tunes and formations.
The artistry that goes into that, I think people don't realize.
Every movement has... So we start making these Chinese warrior logos. Now, you know, the audience has seen the band make a circle and a square before, but this is an ancient warrior formation, and so is this one with the star.
Madden and Ma have designed hundreds of complicated formations and movements, all inspired by Chinese music, history, and cultural imagery.
That's pretty clearly a dragon, and she drew that as well. And then the dragon's going to move a little bit.
These are all band formations,
yeah.
Forming a dragon,
yeah.
And moving.
Kind of wiggle around.
Music from world-class composer Tan Dunn will be featured throughout the program. Dunn won the Academy Award for Best Soundtrack for the 2000 film Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. But like all of Jennifer Wen Ma's work, Saturday's show will peel back many layers of art and history.
Jasmine Flower is one of the productions in the show, and the Jasmine Flower is a traditional Chinese folk tune. The best analogy that I've heard is it would be kind of like Amazing Grace to us. Not America the Beautiful, it's not patriotic, but it's more spiritual in its connection to our Chinese student in the band, Louis Han. Louis, I asked him to get up and talk to the band about Jasmine Flower. When did you first hear Jasmine Flower? He says, when I was a little kid. I mean, it's in every school, it's in every home, it's cultural. You can hear the trumpets working on it in the distance right now. It's so sacred and important that it be done authentically and beautifully. But Jennifer, the artist, said, oh, be careful. And again, her orientation to an American college marching band is not, she's not aware of how beautifully we can play. So I played her a recording of the alma mater. I played her a recording of the Shadows, this big, huge brass band playing this beautiful hymn tune, basically. And she went, oh, I get it, I see.
The Art of the March. Cues from Sun Tzu's The Art of War will be featured at Spartan Stadium Saturday. There will also be football. For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
And coming up on Current State, Nathan Triplett leaves office next Tuesday after 8 years on the East Lansing City Council and 2 years as mayor. We'll talk with him about the recent election, the incoming council, and what's next in his future. Plus, we'll chat with maestro Enrique Domecq about the Flint Symphony's concert this weekend, where the maestro will break down Mahler's superstitious Ninth Symphony into bite-sized pieces. That and more after the break. Stay with us. It's Current State. The sounds of Blues Chanteuse Rachel Brown on our classic Steinway piano here back in August on Current State. Tomorrow on Live Music Friday, we welcome local indie singer-songwriter Kate Peterson. You may know her as half of the folk music duo Nervous But Excited. Kate's also the organizer of the annual Women in the Arts Festival in East Lansing, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary. Kate Peterson tomorrow on a Current State Live Music Friday. We hope you can join us for that. I'm Mark Bayshore. 2 years ago, our next guest made history in East Lansing. At age 30, City Councilman Nathan Triplett became the youngest mayor in the city's history. Triplett was first elected to the council in 2007, but he began his service to the city even earlier, working on the city's Human Rights Commission while attending Michigan State University. Mayor Triplett was defeated in his re-election bid last week. Next Tuesday evening, he'll relinquish his duties as mayor at the upcoming city council meeting. He joins us now in the studio to talk about his tenure and the future. Nathan Triplett, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
Your loss in the last election was a surprise to many people in the community. Was it to you?
I mean, obviously, whenever you're running for election, you know it's a possibility. And I think certainly it was a little bit of a surprise. But I think on balance, given the way that the campaign was going and sort of the steady drumbeat of negativity that we'd been dealing with for about 10 months, it wasn't shocking. Mm.
Mark Meadows, who will be rejoining the city council next Tuesday, said on this program last week that support for you in polling went away during the last couple of weeks of the campaign and was linked to negative campaigning, which is linked to mailers sent out by the Greater Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, which interestingly endorsed you and Mark Meadows and Shanna Draheim. Let's listen back to Mark Meadows' comments last week.
That drop seemed to start almost immediately after the negative campaigning in the community began by the chamber. So I think that you can link the two of those together, that prior to that time, Nathan seemed to poll in second place pretty consistently, but there was a precipitous drop after that negative campaigning began.
Was that your undoing?
I don't believe so. I think Mark's identified the perhaps the cause, but misidentified the culprit in this case. You know, this campaign, I think if you look over the course of the last 25 years in East Lansing politics, was certainly one of the most negative, and the chamber's mail was part of that. But it was a negative campaign from day one from some of my opponents, and I think that clearly had an impact. And whenever you're trying to build something up, it's more difficult than tearing something down. And when you add to that being the only incumbent in the race, I think that process, frankly, started a lot earlier. And the chamber mail may have ended up being a contributing factor, but I don't believe it was decisive. Mm.
He was victorious. He told the Lansing City Pulse this week, quote, "I think there will be a delay in development," unquote. And the results of the election are being, I think, widely interpreted as a desire for a more cautious approach to development. Is the reason you're out because you were too preoccupied with development, too eager to offer tax breaks and incentives to developers?
I don't believe so. I think there certainly is an element of community frustration, which frankly I share with the length of time it's taken to deal with the corner of Abbott and Grand River, the former City Center 2 project now, the Park District. I think some of this language actually becomes code in our community. So when people talk about blight or development, more often than not what they're talking about is that corner. And I think that's a reasonable frustration, although I think, again, misidentifying the cause, that is clearly a challenge created by a lack of financial wherewithal on the part of the private property owners, not the city government, that approved not one but two site plans there. And I think this is a great example of how you campaign in poetry but are forced to govern in prose. No matter how many times it's repeated, it won't be the case that the city gives tax breaks or giveaways to these developments. We do use tax increment financing to help support public spaces and public infrastructure, but it's very difficult when you actually talk to a resident and explain we're using public money to fund things like sewers and the Ann Street Plaza, that they're able to come away with that thinking, yep, that's a giveaway. It's a great campaign tactic. It just has very little relevance for how government actually operates.
And this can get very confusing here because many residents of East Lansing, I'm sure you'd agree, would prefer to have seen action on the Strathmore property years ago, yet we're hearing of more caution. And caution, I think you'd agree, is probably important, but more of it would seem to suggest an even longer wait for redevelopment on the corner of Abbott and Grand River. There's a very mixed message there, it seems to me. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. I think the fact of the matter is this is not a process issue when it comes to that corner. We have had more public hearings, more charrettes, more community input opportunities, all of which have yielded essentially the same result in terms of the outline of what residents want to see there. The issue isn't that the community doesn't know what they want on that corner. The issue is having a private sector partner with the financial wherewithal to be able to build the project that they've proposed. And that's something that the new council will have to grapple with. It's not within their power to make the financing work for that project. That's up to the private sector. That's what has been a challenge for us for the last several years, and it will continue to be a challenge for the new council dealing with that reality.
Nathan Triplett is our guest here on WKAR's Current State. What do you think is most likely to happen on the corner? It appears it'll go back to the bank early next year. Is there a consensus view on that?
Well, what we do know is that the foreclosure process has moved forward. It's now in the redemption period. The current property owner will have until early 2016 to be able to regain the property by paying the money that is due on that loan. If he's unable to do that, the lenders will then possess that property free of his redemption rights, at which point they could sell it to another interested owner. I think in the long run, what will have to happen for that property to be successful is the lender will have to sell that property to a new owner with the financial wherewithal to build a project, which is critical for seeing it move forward, but ultimately is not in the control of the city. That's a private transaction that clearly the new council and city staff will take great interest in, but they won't have a role, just as we have not had a role in those private transactions in making it happen.
How long of a list of potential developers for that space exists? Is this a pretty small club of people who really have the wherewithal to turn that around?
Well, I think actually it could be a fairly lengthy list depending on how willing to negotiate the lender is in this case. It has always been a challenge there when you have someone in possession of the property, be it the owner or a lender, who's trying to get significantly above market price for those parcels. So I think if you have a scenario where the lender is willing to be reasonable, that the attractiveness of that parcel could lead to a situation where there is an owner with wherewithal there. But again, those are all private transactions that we'll all watch with great interest, but ultimately the city will not have control over.
And for the record, who is the lender?
DDR.
Who is that?
So DDR is a financing company that's been involved with lending on this project from the beginning. So it's not actually a bank. It's a group of individuals who have pooled resources to be able to invest in projects like this.
This is Mid-Michigan
organization? Regional, not Mid-Michigan. Regional.
Okay. Yeah. What other thoughts do you have about how the new council might reshape the direction in East Lansing?
Well, my primary hope for the new council is not just during this campaign, but frankly over the course of the last couple of years. I think the quality of our community dialogue has suffered. It's been divisive, and I think that for us to be able to tackle some of the challenges that remain, and perhaps more importantly, to figure out innovative ways to move our community forward, we have to get over that division. So there was an intense campaign. The voters have decided the direction that they want to head, and I hope that the new council will stay focused on being able to set aside those disagreements that existed on the campaign trail and focus on putting what's best for the community forward and creating a dialogue that really is welcoming to everyone in the community and not just to a preferred subset.
And what exactly led to this change in the dialogue?
Well, I think you've seen a lot of things, and this is not a unique phenomenon to East Lansing. Certainly there has been some community organizing that has happened among residents who are essentially anti-growth that may have lit the fire. But when you combine with that candidates who have a more narrow scope of issues that they're focusing on and the local media landscape here in this region in particular, the rise of blogs that are motivated by a certain ideological bent, again, not unique to East Lansing at all. You see this at every level of government and in local governments across Michigan. Those are not factors that combine to create a positive community dialogue. What they do create is an intense but often negative community dialogue that perhaps most importantly completely obscures the nuance that surrounds many difficult policy issues that government faces generally and local government like East Lansing faces in particular.
We just have a little bit of time. Talk to us about the role you want to play in the next couple of years. Are you going to drop out? You're going to just cleanse the palate here, or are you going to stay involved?
No, certainly not. I plan on staying involved. Community service is in my blood. It has been since I was a very young man. Figuring out exactly where I think I can have the most impact will take a little time. And honestly, here in the immediate future, my wife and I are expecting our first child any day now, so we'll be focused on our son and having an opportunity to enjoy those days with him that we'll never get back.
Well, we've been talking with the mayor of East Lansing, Nathan Triplett. He's been on the city council for 8 years and served as mayor for the last two. He will step down as mayor on Tuesday. We wish you the best. Congratulations on the new arrival. We hope that all goes well, and we commend you for your service.
Thanks for having me, and thank you very much.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Several of John Irving's novels have found success on the big screen as well as on the bookstore shelves. Scott Southard gives us his take on whether the author's new novel, Avenue of Mysteries, is destined for the same success.
I've been a fan of John Irving ever since I was a teenager. After sneaking my dad's copy of The World According to Garp off the shelf, I devoured it in secret. Some of Irving's novels, like Garp and A Prayer for Owen Meany, are works of genius that will outlive their author. Then there are books that seem like they're just markers between greater works to come. John Irving's new novel, Avenue of Mysteries, is one of the latter. Like Garp, it follows the life of a writer. Juan Diego grew up impoverished in Mexico. He is the son of a prostitute and doesn't know who his real father is. Juan's nickname then was the dump reader. He would steal books before they were put in the flames with the rest of the garbage, and he would read everything. Irving plays with magical realism in this book through three unique and captivating female characters. The first is Lupe. She is Juan Diego's little sister and can read minds. She has a severe speech impediment, making her brother the only one who can understand her. Juan acts as her translator. Lupe tells him what everyone is thinking, and he decides what he will tell others and what he will keep secret. Like most of Irving's novels, it covers two different periods in time. Half of the novel focuses on the early life of Juan Diego and Lupe. It follows their time in the dump and a very questionable circus. The other half focuses on Juan Diego as a much older man. A successful author now, he is traveling the world. It is during this trip that he meets Dorothy and Miriam, the other two mysterious women in the novel. Miriam and Dorothy are mother and daughter, and they live on the road. They seem to know something about every country and every hotel, but there is something very off about the pair. They follow Juan Diego on his trip, and their intentions with him are never clear. Things get even more muddled as he slips in and out of relationships with both of them. Throughout this journey, Juan Diego's heart medication plays with his mind and dreams. He flips back and forth between the two times in his life. He changes locations with nothing more than a nod or a blink. For fans of Irving, there are a lot of gold nuggets to discover. Yes, there is a small reference to wrestling, but sadly no bears, like in the Hotel New Hampshire. And a transgender man plays an important role in the story, like in Garp, and the more recent in One Person. I always enjoy Irving when he challenges himself, and that is happening here. I'm not sure if Avenue of Mysteries will bring new readers into the fold of Irving fans, but it definitely reminded me, after so many years, why I'm still a fan of his writing. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
And Scott Southard is the author of the new novel, Permanent Spring Showers, and A Jane Austen Daydream. You can follow his writing via his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard, at sdsouthard.com. Well, this Saturday, the Flint Symphony will be dissecting a symphony and showing the audience what makes it tick. Current State's Jamie Paisley joins me now after speaking with the man doing the dissecting, Maestro Enrique Domecq. There's no formaldehyde involved here, is there, Jamie?
No formaldehyde. Instead, Maestro Domecq will have the Flint Symphony on stage for the beginning to play some of those melodic bits that Mahler will weave throughout his final symphony. And he'll also discuss something that has become a bit of a, you know, legend, even a superstition when it comes to those Romantic era symphonies, where it wasn't 13 which was the scary number. No, instead it was 9.
Well, I always make a joke, you know, that it says bad luck to be superstitious. But they were superstitious because, let's see, Beethoven, even though he started sketches of the 10th, he died after the 9th. Schubert died after the 9th. Bruckner died after the 9th. So Mahler had all that feeling, too, that he was going to die, and he was diagnosed with a heart disease when he was writing the 6th. And he lost his child, too. And when he wrote Das Lied von der Erde, the Song of the Earth, he felt that he was avoiding the curse. So he interpreted it with the last symphony, the 9th symphony, with the idea that it was going to fool fate, fool the destiny. But nevertheless, he tried to describe the fate of his life, how he was really working out things, and so he can really survive that. And he did the sketches of the 10th symphony. Actually, he finished 2 movements, and then he didn't make it. So still, I think, like someone told me one day, in America, we know it ends after the 9th inning. Even from the very beginning, when he writes just a little rhythm, pa-pam, pa-pam, it has the heartbeat. He uses a little enhancement with the French horn. Pom, 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 pom. And that little pa-pam, pa-pam appears throughout the whole symphony. But of course, the heartbeat beats accordingly to your state of mind and state of anxiety. The heartbeat can be faster or slower. It can have a different thing. But the settle of the thing, you can feel that it's going to be a fate. And now we're going to go through see the adventures that he's going to go through, how much he conquered throughout his life. Even though he only lived 50 years plus, he accomplished a lot more than a lot of other people.
The second movement of Mahler's 9th Symphony uses a signature style of his, the Ländler, an Austrian folk dance, which Mahler described very explicitly. In the tempo of a leisurely Ländler, somewhat clumsy and very crude. And what does the Flint Symphony's maestro Enrique Domecq think of that description?
It's absolutely perfect, because the Ländler is an old style of waltz. It's rustic. So what he wanted to do in his second movement, he was going back to his childhood in the fairy tales. So a lot of the times, you know, the dwarves and the elves, they're dressed up like woodcutters and, you know, like Pinocchio dressing, and they would dance clumsily. So that's why the music is clumsy, because they were not really elegant or refined. And that was not the idea. They didn't even try to be refined. They tried to be what they were, big guys cutting woods, boom, 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 and tried to mock at certain moments elegancy. And of course, being big guys was not so easy. Experts consider Mahler's Ninth Symphony as a real turning point into the 20th century music, which would be opening the new Viennese school, the new thing. So that's the beginning of the new era. So closes a door and it starts a new one. Some people say The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, who was actually premiered a couple years later in 1913, but that one is more, it was a ballet, so it used choreography. So you had images, and in this one you don't have the images, you create your own images. And that's the idea of the Viennese school too. Then you have all the images coming out of the sounds. Then you can have colors, like scrubbing using the colors. And in Mahler's music you hear colors too, you develop images. And that's the whole idea of this music, that can go have the vibrations in your brain and can create all these kind of images.
Now, for this follow-up to Gustav Mahler's Song of the Earth, Das Lied von der Erde, which has a certain inspiration from the Far East, Mahler's Ninth Symphony instead includes a distinctively Greek dedication, To My Brothers in Apollo. For Maestro Enrique de Mac, who's conducting Mahler's Ninth this Saturday at the Whiting in Flint, the Brothers in Apollo dedication has a far more holistic meaning to the composer.
It was a little bit of a mystical thing, because he had several siblings, and some of them die in infancy. So he was always surrounded by death in infancy because of his siblings. And one committed suicide a little older. And Apollo, obviously, it was the god that would bring strength, beauty, and connection to the sun. So the sun is the one that gives life to all of us. And he always was very much attached to the mythology or the Orient, because sometimes, you know, when he wrote Das Lied, it's more oriental. It's all the idea of Asia, China, to be more precise. And here with Apollo, it was always feeling like in like the Germanic mythology too. They are very much connected. They have the gods, and they have the semi-gods, and then they have the heroes, the mortal heroes. And I think that's why he was referring to Apollo more like he was the one that gave him the strength to continue. I'm the number one fan of Mahler. I just think that he really was the composer that connected all the times to the modern times. And I think there's a lot to show to everyone how much he was advanced in his days, how much he had in his brain that he was putting in the music for us to see, not only to hear, but to see. He was a great opera conductor. So he knew stage, and he knew the tricks, how to make people believe something was happening on stage, and it was just acting. But he wrote his symphonies with the idea that the imagination is bigger than anything you can do on a stage.
You can let your imagination go wild this Saturday evening at the Whiting in Flint as Maestro Enrique de Mac leads the Flint Symphony in Mahler's ninth and final symphony. Tickets and more information about the Flint Symphony Orchestra at thefso.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Glad you could join us. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, it's another Football Saturday in East Lansing this weekend, but did you know that MSU isn't the only home team in Spartan Stadium history? Back in the days of hippie clashes with police over the war in Vietnam, the two sides met on the gridiron in games that were dubbed the Bull Bowl. Current state Scott Pohl talks with two men who played in the Pigs versus Freaks football games at Spartan Stadium and at East Lansing High School. Also on a Live Music Friday, local indie singer-songwriter Kate Peterson joins us. And we want to remind everybody, tomorrow WKAR's Melissa Benmark begins a new journey. She is retiring from WKAR and from MSU. She's been at the station here since 1989. A quick reminder that we've created a special page at WKAR.org where listeners can bid Melissa a fond farewell. A lot of great messages on there already. Be sure to add yours. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Melissa Benmark, April Van Buren, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and to Drew Hill. We're a podcast as well. Connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, on social media. Get with us on Twitter, at KAR Current State. On Facebook, we're at Current State from WKAR.org. We'll be looking for you Friday. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR.